I want to speak to you today from the series, and I want to finish looking at marriage and singleness today. And we've been looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, a passage that hardly ever gets preached on in the church, but I'd like to look on some other passages to talk to you, particularly those who are single. I want to talk to you about what to look for in a mate. If you're looking, now you don't have to be looking. Just because you're single doesn't mean you're looking. But oftentimes pastors will be asked questions, you know, who should I be looking for? I mean, what are the characteristics that I should be seeking as I'm dating a variety of people? Who would make a good marriage companion? And so I'd like to talk to you about that. And I'd like to begin by pointing out three or four statistics that you may or may not be aware of. The first you would be aware of, which is this. The divorce rate in America is 40 to 50%, and I think most people know that about half of the marriages that happen in America end up in divorce. But there are three other statistics which you may not fully be aware of. If you go back to 1960 in America and use that as a benchmark, in 1960 about 75% of adults in America were married. Today that number is less than 50%. Statistic number two, right now, about half of the population, about one half of individuals in America will at some point live in a romantic relationship with an individual that they aren't presently at that time married to. Third statistic, in 1960, the average age for a person to get married, if you're a guy, was 22. If you're a girl, it was 20. Today, if you're a guy, it's 29. If you're a girl, it's 27. And what all that seems to say is this, that people are scared to get married. Now, it says a lot more than that. But people are choosing to be single. People are choosing to wait till they're closer to 30 than 20 to get married. And again, that means a lot of things, but one of the things I think that it means is that people are skittish to get married. So what I want to do this morning is I want to drum up some business for myself. I want to talk somebody into getting married. It's not that bad. We've been talking about it, and maybe we made it sound bad, but I just want to reassure you by giving you some characteristics of a person that I think would make a very good mate. And if you're dating the person of which I'm talking about, Christmas is coming. You might think about buying a ring, all right? So the first characteristic, if you're looking at a person and saying, who should I marry? I think the first characteristic would be an individual that shares your values. There's a place in Genesis chapter 24. Abraham, the great man who basically founds Judaism, but he's traveled 1,200 miles. He's come to the promised land, and his son has grown of age where his son is now going to get married or is marriageable age. The father, it's his job to find a mate. So he says in verses 3 and 4 of Genesis 24, he says, he can't marry a person from Canaan. And so he sends a servant all the way back 1,200 miles to find somebody from their hometown for the son to marry, for Isaac to marry, because he says, I don't want him to marry somebody from this place. Now, why would Abraham say, I don't want him to marry somebody from this place? Part of it is religion. They were worshipers of false gods. But he needed to marry somebody from his town, from his family structure. He needed to marry somebody who had been raised like he had been raised. He needed somebody who really did understand him, who had his value system. It's very important. There's a woman named Ann Vogt who was a marriage counselor. She wrote a lot of books, but she said after counseling 5,000 couples, 5,000 plus, she said, when I started marriage counseling, I would have said what all the other books say, which is that communication is the most important aspect of a good marriage. And she said, so we focus, at least in premarital counseling, on communication, teaching people how to use I comments. Don't say you, say I. Teaching them how to actively listen. teaching them how to say the word as well, how to actively listen, so that you say, what I hear you saying is this, but I feel, use feel. So she said, we would teach people how to communicate to help in marriage. She said, but the truth of the matter was, now after 30 years of counseling, I don't think communication is the most important thing you need in the marriage. She said, I think commonality of value is the most important thing that you have. What's important to that individual is what's important to you. She said, because you can use all the right communication, but if he still wants to die with $10 million in the bank and you want to live in a cabin by the lake or cabin by the river, it's still not going to work. I mean, your value is simplicity. You want a nice, simple life. And he wants a jet-setting lifestyle where he owns four houses in the end and he's going all over the place. You have different values. You want 8 kids? He don't want any kids. You can communicate all you want, but communication in that aspect is not going to bridge the gap between variety of values. She says, you're going to have to find somebody who values what you value. If you want to make a lot of money in your life, marry somebody who doesn't want a simple life. If you don't want kids, don't marry a woman who wants kids. If you want kids, don't marry somebody who tolerates kids. Find somebody who values what you value. By the way, secondly, and this is really just part of the first point, if you're a Christian, marry a Christian, because again, that's sort of implied in the values. If you are a Christian, you have a certain set of values. Now, that's if you're a true Christian. You can be a Christian in name only. It's possible to be a person who believes themselves to be a Christian, but your faith or your belief system in no way shapes the decisions that you make. And in that case, you would be a believer in name only, but you're not a believer in action and thought. And so in that case, you maybe wouldn't have that much in different with a person who wasn't a Christian. But if you are a believer, and if that belief system is central to how you live your life, it radically shapes your values. And it would be almost impossible, and I think impossible, and that's why the Bible says, don't marry a non-Christian. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 6. If you are a Christian, by the way, if you're a non-Christian, why would you want to marry a Christian either? If the values are different, you're not going to understand each other. She's not going to understand you, and you're not going to understand her. But if those values inform you, it would almost be impossible again for a non-Christian to understand why you think the way that you do if they have not experienced what you have experienced. Changes your whole way that you think. It changes how you view money. It changes how you view family. It changes the purpose in life for you. It changes, again, the dominance of worshiping God. I mean, your life becomes a life of worship, and all of that. The only thing that a person who hadn't experienced that might be able to say is, well, that works for you, and I'm glad that that works for you. But they can't understand that. You need to marry an authentic Christian if you are an authentic because of the value system. Now, how do you know if a person, by the way, is an authentic Christian? Because there are a lot of phonies. Jesus said there are a lot of phonies. How would you know? There's no one way to know, but I'll tell you, if you got to make a split second decision of if a person is a legitimate Christian or not, I think the best test, and it's not the only one and it's not foolproof, but the best test is whether or not it's easier to be a Christian around them. It's a really good test. Because the devil is tempting you. Right? That's his business, to tempt you and lead you astray. So if you're dating somebody, or you go out on a date with somebody, or you're spending time with a person, and it's a lot harder to be a Christian around them than not, at the very least, they're doing the work of Satan in your life. Because they're leading you astray from the path God wants you to walk. Now, at the very least, they're being used by Satan. But I would say probably they're not an authentic Christian. Because an authentic Christian, when you're around authentic Christians, it's easier to be a Christian. I think when you look at couples and they're Christians and they get married, inevitably in that marriage, it's easier to serve Christ. If you're in a marriage, and you know what, it's harder to serve Christ, it probably means somebody, whatever they're saying, really isn't an authentic Christian. Because if they were, your relationship with Christ would be as important as their relationship with Christ, and their relationship with Christ is the most important thing in their life. So it ought to be easy for you. And again, when you get married, and you're married to a Christian, there ought to be ways in which you say, my life is easier, my relationship with God is easier because I'm in this marriage. See, my wife, hey baby, I think it's easier for my wife to be a Christian because she's married to me, in some ways. Because here's the thing, at least in one way. My wife will say to me frequently, I wouldn't go to church as much if I wasn't married to you. That's one way that I help her, because I understand it's hard to get three kids ready to get to Sunday school, because I'm already in the office. And then I'm already at the church, and she's got to get them all lined up to get them to Sunday night. And she's been quite honest with me. I'd miss a lot more church if I wasn't your wife. So I help her. I'm helping. Now, I'll tell you one way she helps me. My wife will say one of two things to me over the course of a year fairly consistently, very fairly repetitively. One thing she says to me is, be nice. The other thing she'll say, and she'll follow up, be nice, usually with this comment or somewhere close to it, she'll say, there's no excuse not to be kind to somebody. Because she can see it in my eyes. Yeah. And she'll say, I know you don't like what they're doing. I know you think they need to be confronted. I know you think something needs to be said, and maybe something needs to be said, but there's no excuse for you not to be kind to them. And some of you need to buy her a Christmas present. No, I'm joking. She helps me. I'm a kind of person. I'm that personality type that I can be nice and nice and nice, and then it piles up and steam starts to come out of my head like a cartoon character. And today's the day of reckoning for everybody who's ticked me off the last 3 months. You know, that's the kind of person it is. But she's helpful in that. She helps me not to explode. She says, remember, you're a Christian. Remember the fruit of the Spirit. Remember that? That's you. So even if you have a tough conversation, be nice, don't be rude. Now, I don't always take her advice, but that's not her fault. I mean, the Lord is still working on me there. Marry somebody who will make you a better Christian. Marry somebody who shares your value system. Thirdly, you need to marry a problem solver. Life is a series of problems to work through. Marriage is specifically a series of problems to work through. And it's a little harder when you're married, because you can fix your problems when you're single, and fixing the problem is what's best for me. But in the marriage, you've got to reach a mutually beneficial agreement. So a good problem solve is, you're happy with this decision, and I'm happy with this decision too. That's what problem solving is about. Some people think they're problem solvers, and they're not. They run over people. They hound people. They pout. They get mad, and they force everybody to cave to them. But that's not problem solving. The problem goes away, but you did a lot of damage in the long run to fix that problem. A good problem is where you're happy with the decision, and I'm happy with this decision. It was a fair decision for both of us. And life is about problem solving. You're going to have many problems in your life that will have to be solved. And if you don't solve them, you know what you got? You got problems. Got problems in your marriage. How do you know if a person is a good problem solver? Look at their life. Are they good at solving problems? You know, if you're looking at a person's life, see how they relate to their parents. Because there are some problems growing up that have to be solved, and they're pretty simple. It shouldn't be, it's not rocket science to fix these kinds of problems. Problems like a curfew. Now, some people have crazy parents, right? They do. Nobody can get along with those parents. Those are difficult parents. But the vast majority of people you will meet don't have crazy parents. They may think so, but their parents are pretty reasonable. And solving things like a curfew ought to be really simple to reasonable people. You need to have a social life. They need to know where you are because good parents know where their kids are at. There ought to be some common ground between your social life and them parenting you, knowing where you're at, so they can sleep well at night. That's not a difficult problem to fix. Dress is not a difficult problem to fix. You need to be allowed to express yourself, and they need to be able to be in public with you and not be embarrassed of you. Now, there ought to be some common ground there. There's a lot of ground that an agreement can be reached on the issue of dress. Privacy is a fairly simple one. You need your privacy. You got your phone, you got your stuff, but again, a good parent knows sort of what their kid's up to, so they need to know what's going on in your life, and you need some privacy. There ought to be some way of fixing that. It's a problem, but you ought to be able to fix it. And if you're dating somebody and they couldn't fix any of that stuff, they fought with their parents over curfews, over dress, over privacy, and a lot of other stuff. You know what? They're not a very good problem solver, because you know what? All that stuff's going to be in the marriage anyway. Plus a lot of others. You don't think you have a curfew in marriage? You think your dad's rough when you walk in at midnight and you didn't know where he where and he didn't know where you were? What do you think your husband's going to say? Of course there's accountability in marriage. You think your wife won't want to know what you're doing on your phone over there? There's privacy issues in marriage. Dress is an issue in marriage. No woman's going to, who's self-respecting, is going to allow a 40-year-old husband to go to town in skinny jeans. There's always dress issues. Always dress. I mean, privacy, dress, curfews, that's in marriage. Plus a lot of other hard stuff like how to parent and how to budget. That's the simple stuff. If they can't deal with the simple stuff, they're not going to deal with the difficult stuff in a marriage. They don't know how to problem solve, which means if you can't solve a problem, you got a problem. Your whole life is going to be fighting. It's none of your business what's on my phone. Well, I'd like to know. Well, it's none of your business. Don't tell me how. I mean, that's what your life is going to be like. Find somebody who can problem solve. You know, I think Stephen Furtick said it like this. He said, we get too tied up with potential when we date. We look at a person and say, oh man, they got so much potential. Think about what they could be. Look at this. There's so much hidden potential in their life. He said, you ought to look at patterns. Patterns is a better predictor than potential. Look at the patterns in their life. I know they got all kinds of potential, but they got a pattern of spending money they don't have. You ought to think about that before you marry. They got all kinds of potential, but they got a pattern of broken relationships. Everybody they're with, they fight with. You better look at the patterns instead of the potential when you want to marry them. They're a good problem solver. Fourthly, or thirdly, however you deal with that first point. Are they a problem solver? Did they share your values? Christianity falls into that. Are they a good problem solver? Are they a forgiving person? Are they a forgiving person? Because marriage is one problem after another to be solved, but it's also one fault after another to be forgiven. And it starts in the morning. starts with the shape of the bathroom, starts with the fact that she ran the hot water out again, and just when I got to a shave, it was, I mean, it starts with things that have to be forgiven, all right? And you need to marry a forgiving individual. Now, everybody says they're forgiving. I mean, you know, somebody might qualify and say, well, I have trouble forgiving them because they did a terrible thing to me. Everybody says, I don't have no problem with forgiving. I'm a forgiving person. How do you know if somebody is really going to be forgiving in that marriage? Or how do you know if they're just a phony? Because, you know, why was it? Hebrews 12 talks about the root of bitterness, right? The root of bitterness. And you think you got it cut, but then it springs up again at the wrong time. Some people have forgiven at some superficial level, but it's still deep down in there. How do you know they aren't harboring that in their heart? Here's how you know, I think. To be a forgiving person, you have to be a person who can show empathy. You can't really forgive a person without identifying with them. You can't. Somebody said, a wise guy said, forgiveness fails when we exclude ourselves from the company of sinners. In other words, he says, you can't forgive if you act like you haven't done anything wrong. You have to be able to empathize with that individual. Jesus in Matthew chapter 18 tells the parable. The guy owes the king like $20 million. The king forgives him. He goes out and the guy owes him 20 bucks and he starts to strangle him. The king finds out and he has the guy thrown in prison for the debt he owed him. But the point of that parable is if you can't remember what you owed, it'll be hard to forgive people who owe you. You have to empathize. You have to say, they're a debtor, but I'm a debtor. You have to empathize with that person. Jesus in John chapter 8, there's a woman caught in the act of adultery and they're going to stone her. And you know that account, many of you would, where Jesus says, all right, you without a sin, you cast the first stone. And what Jesus is doing is a little pastoral care there. He's saying, listen, think about what you've done. If you've sinned, don't stone her. You don't have the right to do that. And what he's saying is, you need to identify with her. Are there ways that you have transgressed the law like this woman? Because think about that. That'll help you not to throw that stone. You have to be able to empathize with the person who has wronged you. And people who don't empathize really haven't forgiven. What you want to hear when you go out to eat with that individual, you don't want to hear them say, they did a terrible thing, but I'm better than that. I forgave them. I forgot, but I've forgiven. You want to look beyond that thinking, and you want to hear whether they empathize with the people who wronged them. You want them to hear, you want to hear something like this. You want them to say, you know what, they haven't really been a very good friend to me. They have failed me, I guess, in a lot of ways. They haven't been a very good friend. But then again, there's a lot of people that I haven't been a very good friend to. You want to hear them say, you know what? They said some things that hurt. But in the course of my life, I've said some things that have hurt too. You want to hear them say, you know, they rejected me and their rejection hurt. But I bet there are some people in my life, and I might even know who they are, who have felt my rejection, and I'm sure it stinged them too. You want to hear them say things like, you know, my parents aren't going to make the magazine, you know, for parenting. I mean, my parents weren't very good. By any definition, my parents weren't that good at parenting. But if I had grown up like they did, I might not have done as good of a job as they did with me. You want to hear empathy, because that's how you know they really have forgiven. They haven't forgiven if they haven't empathized. It's still in there. They've just buried it, and it's going to come out. They haven't got the root out. And so what you want is to marry a person, again, who has the ability to forgive or to empathize with you. You know, when I graduated college, I was 25. And before that time, I thought about marriage, but I knew I probably wasn't getting married until after I got out of college. So I hadn't thought about it too much. But when I got out of college, I thought, well, the next logical step is to think about maybe marriage. And so I was in that thought process. And before that time, I would, if you'd asked me, what are you looking for in a mate? I think I would have said what most people my age would have said. Well, I'm looking for these three or four or five, you know, characteristics. And if I meet a person who has those, then that might be a good match for me. But in the process of graduating, somewhere in there, a wonderful thought hit me that saved my life. The thought was this. You know, I'm looking for the kind of person that I would want to marry, but maybe I ought to be looking for the person who can live with me once they figure out who I am. Because those are two different things. Because they don't know it, and they're not going to fully believe all the stuff in my life that makes me hard to live with. I'm an introvert. No, I'm an introvert. When I come home, I put the sweatpants on, and I'm finished for the day. And I can sit in that chair a while. I'm serious. So, you know, I'm going to have to marry a woman who can put up with me sitting in there for a while. I was joking with somebody. I don't shave between Thursday night and Sunday morning. You know, I zone out, man. I'm out. I'm finished. That's hard to live with. I'm cheap. I mean, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. I drive an 07 Corolla, and it's not because it's a classic. I'm cheap. It's not always easy to live with a cheap guy. I mean, every time she buys something, it's like, how much does that cost? I mean, that's just a natural reflex. What's that cost? That's not easy to live with. I mean, I've got all kinds of bad habits. And, I don't go to bed when I should. I can stay up till 12:30 or 1. I get something in my mind, and I'm off doing that thing. I'm erratic in so many ways. And it dawned on me, you know what? I'm not going to be very easy to live with. I need to find somebody who can be forgiving. And the Lord led me to a forgiving person. You need to find a forgiving person. Now, I'm sure you're perfect and you're going to be easy to live with. But if you're not perfect and you have the self-awareness and know you're not going to be all that easy to live with, you better find somebody who can forgive all your stuff. Fifthly, and I'm finished, or fourthly, however, find somebody who is happy. Find somebody who has shared values. Find somebody who is a problem solver. Find somebody who is a forgiving kind of person. Find somebody who's happy. Put Philippians. I had a lot of Bible verses I skipped over today, by the way. Everything I said is in the book. I can go back. What is in the book? Philippians 4, 11, 13. Now that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. In other words, he says, I know how to have nothing, I know how to have a lot. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. What's he saying? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can be happy wherever I'm at. Happiness is a habit. It is. It doesn't have to do with your surroundings. Contentment is sort of a habit. Because listen, life is never perfect. It's the 80-20 rule. At best, it's 80% right, but there's still 20% of lack. You can't get life all the same at the same time. Your relationships may be going well, but your business may not be going well. Your business may be going well, but your relationships may not be going. I mean, it's all not going to be perfect. And if you dwell on the negative, you're going to be unhappy your whole life. You just are. Happiness is a learned trait of dwelling on what's right with the world. Earlier in that passage, Paul will say, whatsoever things are noble, good, kind, of good report. That's what I think about. I could think about all the bad stuff, but I have learned to be content through practicing looking at what's right in the world. And you need to be happy. You know how you know if a person is going to be happy in your marriage? Whether they're happy when they're single. If they're not happy when they're single, I'm sorry, you're giving yourself too much credit if you think they're going to be happy married to you. No. If they're not happy when they're single, they haven't learned the practice of happiness. They haven't learned the secret of being content. Because listen, single is great. It is great. Marriage is great, but both have negatives attached to them. I remember in seminary, and I'm winding down here, I used to envy Dan and Jenny Miller. They were married in seminary. We were not. And they would come in, and they were so cute together. And I was there, and I was far away from home. And I would say, I wish I had somebody to go home to like Dan. They're such a cute couple. They spend time. That would be nice. But then I would hear Dan talk. And Dan had to be part-time, and he would say, you know, I can't be full-time in seminary. I got a family to support. And I was able to give myself to study in ways that Dan was. I didn't have the financial responsibilities of Dan. And so I began, you know, to think, you know, there are things that I don't have, but there's advantages to being single. That's how you're happy when you're single, by the way. You just focus on the advantages. Now, if you get married, there are things you don't have, like freedom. You can't do what you want. We got a fourth kid coming, and I got to tell you, four feels like twice as many as three to me. I mean, it's overwhelming. I was talking to somebody the other day. I said, life is like standing in a driveway where they've poured cement, and I can feel it getting tighter around me. I can't move. My freedom is gone. But marriage is great if you don't focus on your loss of freedom. It can be great. It's wonderful to have somebody to come home to. It's wonderful to have little kids to snuggle with. I'd be happy married if I didn't have little kids to snuggle with. But it's nice. We're going to keep them. But I mean, you can be married. You can be married without kids and have a wonderful life. I'm not saying anything. But there are problems with everything. That's what I'm trying to get. There's problems with everything. And if you focus on the problems, if you have a pattern of focusing on the problem, you're not going to be happy single, and you're not going to be happy married either. So listen, if you're dating somebody, you're both Christians, you share values, they're a pretty good problem solver. They practice forgiveness, they're good at forgiveness. They're good at empathizing. It's just not a shallow thing. They're able to forgive at a deep level. And they're a happy person. You might want to think about marrying them. You might. Seriously. And again, people say, I don't know if I should marry. I mean, what's going to happen? You're going to have to take the plunge sometime. And I would plunge with a person who is a good problem solver and a forgiving person and a happy person. You might have found somebody that you really want to consider spending your life with. Do it. Christmas is coming, right? Do it. Buy that ring. Proceed with confidence in this endeavor. Now, I'm going to finish where you think that I'm going to finish. So give me about 1 minute here. I'm a Christian preacher, right? So you know what I'm going to say. It's important to find that person, but it's probably more important to be that person. As it's still not going to work if you're not that person. You may find that person, but if you're not that person, you still got problems. And Jesus Christ can help you become that person. There's nothing that's going to help you become a problem solver any more than Jesus, because Jesus can begin to give you love that you never had before. And really, to be a great problem solver, you need to be able to look that person and say, I don't want to gain at their expense. I want to reach a situation that benefits them and benefits me because I love them. Love tends to help you become a much better problem solver. Jesus Christ can help you be a forgiving person. When He floods you with His forgiveness, it unleashes forgiveness in you. It does. And Jesus can teach you the secret of contentment. Funny thing, Paul said, I had to learn it. Who taught him? I think Jesus taught him how to be content. Holy Spirit can help you and guide you into all things. Will you stand with me?